Whether it's her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. This is part 222 of Aaron Burr.
Burr.
Perfect.
Okay.
America's drunk uncle. Big shout out to our super producer, research associate, Mr. Max Williams. Hello. I'm Ben. Big shout out to you, Noel. Oh, we got a lot of weird stuff ahead. Sad stuff, too.
A lot of weird stuff. Sad stuff. Copiously little drinking. But I think Max points out somewhere in this episode that everyone was just kind of drunk all the time. And Burr, I think he just, the whole drunk uncle thing. It's just more of like a kind of a crystallization of his personality.
And I'm still, this will make sense later, folks. I'm still looking at this old Delmonico's menu, and I just can't figure out some of the things on here. What is cabinet pudding?
It's just like pudding that you leave in a cabinet for a really long time and just see what happens. Roll the dice.
This battle for New York is bad. And on some level, Burr, despite his own miscalculations and his own warts and imperfections and ugly bumps of a career, he says Hamilton is one of the big reasons I lost this election. And that's probably not true. But what we're seeing is there was already a lot of baggage these guys were carrying around.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the biography we're referring to refers to Hamilton as despising Burr at this point.
Yes.
So there's definitely like serious bad blood between these gentlemen that is just starting to metastasize. Can blood metastasize? Sure. For the purposes of description.
Sure.
You get it. You get it.
Blood cancer is a real thing. Frightening. We actually talked about that, I think, on our saxophone episode at some point.
Ah, yes, the sexy phone episode.
Yes. And so this big duel that is one of the climactic moments of the Hamilton musical, it happens because of a kind of a slight thing, like a tiny misstep where ordinarily you would just talk it out with your buddy. But at this point, their relationship is like cans of open paint and oily rags in a non-ventilated room where someone keeps playing with a lighter, even though lighters weren't invented yet. You get it. So in 1804, it's February. It's cold out. There's a guy, Dr. Charles D. Cooper, a.k.a. the Coops, is what his boys called him back in the day.
They're all hanging with Mr. Cooper.
Mm-hmm. So the Coops is at this dinner party. And at this party, you know, which is just an opportunity for networking and talking for these guys. Thank you for the beep, Max. At this party, Hamilton's like, you know who sucks? Aaron Burr. That guy's just like the worst. And then some people turn around and he like stands up. I'm picturing it like 1980s comic,
and,
you know?
And standing up.
And he's like, first off, Burr.
What's the deal with Burr guy? Yeah, an article on PBS, The American Experience, described him as speaking eloquently and forcefully against Burr. Cooper later wrote a letter to Philip, I think it's Schuyler, and I think I might have said Schuyler earlier. It's S-C-H-U-Y-L-E-R.
It's an unfair name.
I think so, too. It's like one of those.
It's like Worcester.
It's like Hermione. You know, you read it in the book, you think it in your head, and then you say it out loud, and you were wrong the whole time.
Or New Madrid out in Missouri.
That's right. Exactly. So in this letter, he made a reference to a particularly, quote, despicable opinion that Hamilton had shared about Burr.
He was like, I don't think he washes his butt.
Yeah.
And everyone said, you know what? I can see it.
Seems legit. And then, of course, you know, to add insult to injury, the letter gets published in a New York newspaper. Right. How does that? That doesn't seem right. That seems real dirty.
Well, this is also their main source of publicly shared information.
That's true.
This is their Twitter.
It's a good
this
point.
Is their social media.
Point. But like to publish a private, was it with his knowledge? He or was it with the writer's knowledge?
This letter is written by Cooper to Hamilton's father-in-law. So the word gets around. It's Cooper who's telling tales outside of school.
That's right.
So Hamilton is not asked about this being published.
We've seen examples of this, too. I believe it was remember the duel with Lincoln, where there were, like, some letters? There was a letter talking campaign.
Mary Todd went too far.
Exactly. Went a little too far. So you're right. That was exactly the Twitter comparison is completely appropriate. So in June, you know, Burr sees this, obviously.
Sure.
And he's humiliated once again.
He's super not happy.
He's not happy about it. He writes a letter to Hamilton demanding satisfaction, sir. Or at the very least, what's up? What gives?
Bro, WTF.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have this correspondence, and you can see this in the musical where they go back and forth with letters, signing things, your obedient servant. Because they were very polite, even when they were saying terrible things to and about each other. Ultimately, yes, Burr demands that Hamilton denies ever talking trash about him, which sounds kind of childish for grown men, but he says that's the only thing that'll repair this. You got to go out in public and say, I'm not that bad, and you never said that stuff at the party. And this is back when you could just sort of erase history that way. But Hamilton says, hey, I'm principled too, dog. I'm not going to comply with your demand. That would sacrifice my own political career. And yes, my eldest son, Philip, died in a duel just 3 years ago. I oppose dueling.
But I'm also, you know, not going to be a little baby.
But if you want to fart around, you're going to find out. I heard you don't wash your butt.
That's what they say, I think, perhaps.
Really classing it up for a special guest, Alex.
I know. That's what we do. That's how we do it. We're all class here. That's wild, man. I didn't realize that his son had died in a duel. I was also like, the idea of dying in a duel, it seems like so far removed from our modern day. I guess, it's more of like a gentlemanly way to die, but also a very unfortunate, preventable way to die. Yeah. Now it's just called getting shot.
Duels were, I was thinking about this as we were getting ready for this episode last week. Duels back then, at that time, were kind of like how cannabis law is
in the
United States today.
We talked about this in the Lincoln episode, too, where they had to find a spot that was like a gray area.
You gotta find a chill spot.
Yeah. It was decriminalized. You know, dueling possession of a dueling pistol was okay.
Yeah, so duels are illegal at the time, both in New York and in New Jersey. But as they say, everything's legal in New Jersey. So the punishment for dueling, for beefing up with pistols or swords, sabers, your weapon of choice, it's a lot more chill in New Jersey. It's a lot less of a serious thing. So if you kill someone in Jersey and you say, hey, we're having a duel, they'll be like, I don't like it, but hey, it'd be be on your way.
Indeed. So they did need to maintain an air of secrecy around all
right.
this because of the iffy legal, you know, waters. And speaking of waters, in order to keep that secret, they both left Manhattan separately from separate docks before dawn. Duels at pistols at dawn.
Yeah.
It's all coming together now. 5 a.m.
If you win, what a great way to start the day.
I suppose. Yeah, I mean, that breath of fresh air is like a breath of freedom. It's like the first day of the rest of your life. This is July 11th, by the way, 1804.
This is also larger than life, we should say. The place they're meeting is at Weehawken. There's a ledge by the Hudson River.
Nice set piece, right? Mm-hmm. Very John Wick-y.
This has been a scenic overlook dueling ground for a while, and this is a bit larger than life. It's very strange. This was also the site where Hamilton's son died in a duel.
How about that? So both of these men, they're rowed by four men, members of their entourage.
You don't want to tire out your arms.
No, you definitely got to hold up that pistol. To New Jersey, and they arrived, Burr actually arrived first at Weehawken at around 6. Wow, an hour and a half of rowing. It's a lot of upper body workout. Hamilton was fashionably late, around 30 minutes later. And then both men were accompanied by their, it's referred to often as their seconds.
Yes.
So I guess second in command, their assistant, their
aide-de-camp.
Not a valet, exactly.
Aide-de-duel.
Yeah, really, it's more of like a, you know, a... what's the word? Kind of like
it's your wingman.
It's a wingman, but it's someone that would have probably done a political aide, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Often, sometimes a family member, right?
That's right. A close confidant, to be sure.
For sure. And these folks are there to be witnesses, like how you have to have a witness mm-hmm. also sign for some contracts or legal documents. These are two people who each have a horse in the race, right? Because they have chosen to second one of the duelists. And they're going to be the people who say whether or not this was conducted according to the rules.
Oh, so maybe I'm misunderstanding, because it does seem like these two men were kind of political figures in their own right.
Yes.
Is the second just referring specifically to the parlance of dueling?
Mm-hmm.
This is not necessarily like this was their, you know, someone that was on their staff. These were just people that they each chose to accompany them, you know, for the purposes of fulfilling the, I guess, the rules of the duel, the duel
yes.
rules.
Yeah. Hamilton's guy is Nathan, a.k.a. Dirty Nate Pendleton. He is a Revolutionary War veteran and Georgia District Court judge. By the way, I'm just making up all these street names. It's crazy that you guys are letting me get away with that.
What else are you going to do?
I don't know. Dirty Nate?
Who are we to say? Burr, on the other hand, was accompanied by William P. Van Ness, a.k.a. the Loch Ness Monster.
Yep.
A New York City federal judge. Adding to that, Hamilton also had one Dr. David Hossack, which is the only way to say that, who was a professor of medicine and botany at Columbia. Columbia College at the time, now, of course, known as Columbia University.
He also did hair and birthday parties.
That's right.
So, yeah.
Sleight of hand expert and balloon animals.
Mm-hmm. This guy is important because you want to have a doctor on site.
Well, sure.
Duels might not always be fatal. They can be to the death, but they can also be to first blood.
Mm-hmm.
They can be to the one party yielding, mm-hmm. like I yield or, you know, I'm sorry I said that you smell weird, you know, or I'm sorry I said that your spouse looks like an otter.
Mm-hmm. I swear I will never inform other people that you don't wash your butt.
Yes. Yeah.
Nobody needs to know that. Could you, you know, we see sometimes in situations of fights to the death or duels,
sure.
as far back as, you know, medieval times, you could put forth a champion.
Yes.
You know, on your behalf.
It was also considered not necessarily the honorable thing
not
to
chivalrous.
Do at this point.
Yeah.
So what could happen in a duel that reaches the point of actually firing or stabbing at each other is someone draws first blood. And they're like, do you yield? And then if they yield, then the doctor comes by and is like, hey, great job on not everybody dying immediately. Let's see if we can save your life long enough for that hour and a half row back to the city.
And now we'll all go do karaoke together.
Mm-hmm. And this is the origin of Dave and Buster's.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And, of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
They basically randomized to the best of their ability who gets to go on which side. You know, like in a battle rap, you flip the coin and you call heads or tails.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they do to pick the side of the ledge they're going to each be stationed at.
Pretty sure I mentioned this as well in the Lincoln episode, but I'm a big fan of the John Wick movies.
Yes.
And in the last one, or the most recent one, I mean, it's obviously a franchised city. They're probably going to keep making them, but there's a duel that takes place at the Sacré-Cœur in the Montmartre district of Paris.
Yes.
And before that, they have this whole ritualized kind of like drawing of the like these tarot cards that determine like what weapons they're going to use.
Yes.
And all of that. This is sort of a less grandiose version of that, you know, like I like the pomp and circumstance of this duel stuff.
Who doesn't love a little pomp? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? There are worse ways to go, which might sound a little nihilistic.
It does.
But it's nihilistic optimism. So they've got this whole to do. We've got our stage set. We've got our cast here on this secluded ledge.
Yes.
We've got our sides, and you know, at this point, Hamilton does have a storied military and political career. He's a heck of a prolific writer, and he had been pretty dope in the Continental Army. He was George Washington's most trusted boy during
right.
the war,
mm-hmm.
but he probably hadn't actually shot a firearm
in a minute
since the Revolution.
Yeah.
And that's not like riding a bike.
I was going to say, but isn't it like riding a bike? You say no. Okay.
It's not, no.
Okay. Yeah, it does require muscle memory and like strength even, you know, just to like, you know, take the kickback and all of that stuff.
Well, and you want to continually practice.
That's right. Right? That's true.
To keep your dead eye status.
Those skills can atrophy over time.
And Burr, we don't know whether Burr had, how active he had been with firearm maintenance and practice after the war, but there was some evidence that he had been practicing with pistols, with firearms at his crib out in Richmond Hill for a while, because as soon as they agreed to the duel, Burr was going out on a not infrequent basis and just, you know, doing the equivalent of knocking over cans.
That's right. So, I mean, I'm sure we're going to get into this, Ben.
Yeah.
I don't really know, but like, if you kill somebody in a duel, are you then a murderer?
It depends.
Okay.
It depends on the Well, sure, in the eyes of God. Yeah. And any
I also know the next chapter in the story.
Yes. We know. And I know it as well. Actually, you know what? I bet Alex does too. Hamilton doesn't get too in the weeds on this,
no,
but we're going to give you the actual.
He's good.
We're going to give you the actual story. Oh, the Hamilton the musical.
Oh, sorry, I thought. But Hamilton himself also didn't get too into the weeds on practicing his marksmanship.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
And he needed spectacles, so they're standing there, they're facing each other because they had no conflict resolution skills. Hamilton's aiming, and he's like, "Psych, can I take a second and put on my glasses, dog?" And then, Burr is like, "I don't care, man. I hate you. Do whatever you want." And then Hamilton, apparently, Burr didn't know this, and this is a huge part of the Hamilton musical. So spoilers, folks, 3, 2, 1, spoiler alert. Hamilton has already told his close friends, including his second, and he's already written about this in letters. He says, "Look, I'm going to throw away my shot. That's why there's such a big deal about it in the beginning of the musical." He says, "I'm going to shoot wide of Burr. I think duels suck. I think they're cruel."
Yeah, but I got to say, and it's been batting around in my head the whole time.
Yeah.
Why did he agree to it? It seems like such a boneheaded move, such a roll of the dice for someone who's such a, you know, calculated political
sure.
thinker.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it is an antiquated kind of problem, conflict resolution mm-hmm. Scenario. And it is, of course, pretty much illegal, despite them finding these little loopholes. I would just think that, you know, Hamilton was on top. Burr was kind of like this little pissant at this point, who everyone was kind of just ready to be rid of. Why would Hamilton put himself in this situation?
It was wild, man. It was before Twitter.
I guess it's just so, yeah, he's already decided he's going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
He does the thing, like you said, puts away his spectacles. And again, there is also, this is like a, you know, who shot, Han shot first.
Right.
A lot of debate as to who shot first, but Hamilton did miss. Burr, on the other hand, did not. He hit him in the abdomen, right above his hip. How old are these fellas at this point?
They are both 16.
But really?
How old are they
yeah.
at this point? They are both, he got me.
Yeah. What are they, Max? They're
40s? 15. No, they're about, they're pretty close in age, actually. Hamilton, I think at this point is, I want to say he's almost 50. He's like 47-ish.
Yeah, 47 is what the interwebs say. So it does make
he's
sense.
He's not quite 50.
Yeah.
They were still young and spry.
But yeah. still, even if that, you know how medicine was in those days, people just didn't live as long. You get hit in the hip, man. That's not good, even if you're not like super old.
Yeah, we don't know. To be fair, the musical is supposed to lionize our buddy Hamilton. So they don't mention in the musical that it's not clear if he actually missed on purpose to just prove his point, like, duels suck. Boom. I'm classy. Or if he was totally going to kill Burr, got shot first, and that impact
through,
of the bullet
through
the shot for him.
So I say hip. It was more above the hip, but it did fracture a rib, and it absolutely ripped through his diaphragm
yeah.
liver
yeah.
and then lodged in his spine. I mean, they can't do spinal surgery, you know, 100% with 100% precision now.
Right.
You know, this is an absolute death blow.
And he was realistic. He pretty much much said, look, I'm not going to make it. I'm a dead man walking. So they row him back to Manhattan. He survives the first day. He passes away after 31 hours of being shot. He is lucky enough to be surrounded by his family, which doesn't happen for everybody then or now. And he passes away on July 12th, 1804. There's this huge outpouring of grief. His wife, Eliza, is inconsolable. And they have been through a lot, including infidelity, political struggles. They lost a child just 3 years earlier. And Burr...
This is a cautionary tale about dueling.
Oh, yeah. The legal department wants us to tell you, don't duel.
Yeah, for sure.
Don't duel.
Well, you know, it was his son died in a duel, right?
Yes, 3 years before he died.
I guess that's my point, though. It's like knowing that. Why would he not only agree to it? You think he could have said no on the grounds of humanitarian reasons. Like, I lost a son. This is a barbaric practice. Instead, it seems like he did it to try to make a point, but the other guy didn't get the memo and he got blasted.
Literally.
It just seems really short-sighted and dumb. But of course, Hamilton emerges from this for all the reasons that you said as this martyr.
Yes.
You know, lionize is the word you used. I think that's what they wrote a damn musical. I mean, it was many years later, but the story, you know, persevered. And you know, while Burr thought he was going to come off looking like the big, big man on campus
he's the heel.
He's
now.
Canceled.
He's the quizster, basically. Yeah. And he had hoped to, Burr had said, okay, I am going to show that I am upstanding. I am gambling again, and I duel Hamilton honorably. I will restore my reputation. My political career shall be resurrected. He was wrong on both counts. He was super duper wrong. The authorities issue these arrest warrants for Burr, and everybody in New York is saying, this guy is a murderer. And they're like, well, you know, we were all soldiers at some point. We did some killing. He's like, no, but he's one of the bad murderers. Yes. And so Burr has to hightail it to Philadelphia, where he invents cream cheese.
Ben, your misinformation in this episode is admirable.
We're just weaving it in.
You're dropping it in. I love it. It's true that he did have to go on the lam.
He did not invent cream cheese, but he did have to go to Philly.
Yeah, it's true. And cream cheese is objectively good.
It is great.
I like it. I use it
as an ingredient.
It's wonderful as an ingredient. But as you get older, you know what you start to favor? Just the plain.
The plain bagel?
The plain cream cheese.
I
like a plain cream cheese on everything bagel.
Mm-hmm. I like that too.
Two extremes.
Yeah.
Nothing and everything.
We're quite philosophical with our bagels. Also, I tried some everything bagel flavored potato chips.
Oh, yeah. Excellent.
Really?
Well, I'll tell you this. There is a Trader Joe's everything bagel seasoning that you can.
That is good.
Okay, but
I bought the pre-made everything bagel chips
too much?
At Trader Joe's.
Yeah.
They insist upon themselves.
Okay, I can see that.
You know, I bet they'd be good with a smoked salmon dip.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Okay, so we have.
Maybe a hummus?
There we go. I've got a 14-pound can of chickpeas I bought during the pandemic. Did I tell you about this? They never go bad. I thought they were a regular size can when I ordered them. But yeah, I have prepper chickpeas, so I need to make some hummus.
All right.
I'll bring some in for the class.
Please.
So anyway, Aaron Burr is now a pariah, but he does not die. He doesn't pass away. They're late 40s. He doesn't pass away until he's like 80 years old. So his life is
exiled,
just barely halfway through.
That's wild.
And his other adventures that the Hamilton musical won't tell you are pretty nuts, as our research associate for this episode, Mr. Max Williams, puts it.
Didn't he light off for the territories, kind of?
He did. He lit out for the territories. I love that phrase. He leaves for the West ignominiously in 1805, and historians still aren't sure why he was headed that way. People who didn't like him said, we all know this snaky eel of a man.
Ooh, a snake and an eel.
Yeah,
extra wriggly.
He wants to
don't
steal.
Feel lamprey.
Yeah, right. He wants to steal the Louisiana Territory, parts of it, along with Spanish lands. We all know that Burr is a jerk. He's going to try to make his own country. And because this guy's reputation was so bad, people would hear that and they would go, yeah, I don't, you know, I don't have proof, but that guy is kind of a dick.
I know, he seems really sketch. And he, you know, he does make contact with some British officials, ministers from Spain, and even some revolutionary fighters, you know, from Mexico. But a lot of these folks are actually accused of colluding with him for this imagined or real purpose, the idea of starting his own nation.
Or launching a coup.
That's right.
That sounds crazy, because if you have ever been...
Against Washington. Against America. Washington.
If you have ever been to Washington, D.C., caveat, not talking about January 6th, but on any other day of the year, if you've been to Washington, D.C., you know security's a little tight.
Pretty tight.
Right. So... it might sound strange, super villainy, the stuff of legend or fiction to talk about a coup in Washington, D.C. now, but the United States was much younger, much less secure.
Oh, yeah.
So this is a viable, actionable threat.
Yeah. Decent enough militia at your back.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Could be done.
Could be done. And a lot of coups happen with former military officers.
And, you know, this... People were aware, at the very least, of some of these meetings that he was taking. And the district attorney for Kentucky actually tattled on him to Jefferson. So James Wilkinson, who was one of Burr's co-conspirators in this activity, I guess, produced a letter that accused Burr of the worst accusation that any patriot, you know, could be accused of. Treason. And Jefferson then immediately orders his former VP to be taken in, arrested.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it dead or alive? It's got to be alive. They want him alive.
It's arrested so that he can stand trial. That's the idea. But
this is not necessarily stand trial for the murder of Hamilton. This is for treason.
For
colluding with these. Yeah.
He never actually got tried for Hamilton's death.
That was New York that wanted to try for Hamilton.
Yeah.
This is like the federal government is coming after
him. Is it true, though? Was he actually doing this stuff? It seems like a little bit trumped up. Like,
I mean,
we don't know.
We don't know. Still remains unclear. There's not a primary source at this point from my research. There's not a primary source at this point where you have like a correspondence from a British official or from the Spanish minister saying, you know, like por supuesto or whatever.
He was trying to do something. We just don't. There's just not enough proof to know exactly what he was doing. And it was also very unsuccessful.
It could well have been just trying to make investments, you know, in another part of the country or set up a new life for himself, not having to come back to you know. I don't know.
He was also a Littlefinger character, though, you know. So he's like, chaos is a ladder and all that.
Well, and I want to do a little postmortem about him and his character at the end here. But he is put on trial.
Yes.
And he is acquitted. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Marshall acquitted him, saying there was a lack of evidence to fully, bring him up on these charges, but that he had in some form or fashion committed conspiracy, but that he didn't actually take any action against the U.S. government. So usually you think, well, actually, that's not the case. Usually sometimes just being tried is enough to torpedo your reputation and your career, unless you're a certain former president, which seems to not really take.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes. But absolutely, there are some things that just going to trial for them, even if you are acquitted, it's gonna ruin your life.
Toast.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I went to trial for driving puffins extinct. I didn't do it. I mean, I didn't get convicted.
You're probably not going to be elected the head of the WWF.
Or WWE.
World Wildlife Federation.
Yeah, yeah. Wait, there's the other, there are two.
The one with
there?
The panda.
Yeah. Oh, I'm thinking World, what am I thinking of?
Well, the WWF is the
yeah,
the
you're
same.
Right. You're right. World Wildlife Foundation. There's another thing, too. But you know, the question will always be in this weird comparison. You'll say, I wasn't convicted of killing all the puffins. And then anytime you're not in the room, people will go, just between us, how many puffins did he kill, though?
Exactly.
Like, he just got convicted.
Where there's smoke, there's fire.
Right. And so this is a death. This is a political death before a physical death for Aaron Burr.
He's already been absolutely dragged through the mud. He was unpopular before the duel even took place. Now he's been accused or stands, I mean, guilty of, whether it's murder or not, killing a very popular political figure.
And a former close friend, which means that this guy is not trustworthy.
That's right.
Look how he treats his friends. He goes around the world, around Europe, attempting to hang his shingle, attempting to recover some modicum of success is how you'll see it put often in Aaron Burr biographies. He leaves the U.S. 1808, the country that he helped create, and he travels to England. Boo, hiss at this time, if you're American. And he says, maybe the English will support me and bankroll a Mexican revolution. British officials say, oh, you know, it'd be great. Get out. So he flees.
Not interested.
Right. He flees to France. He's like, Napoleon, bro, it's me, the A-bomb. We do big stuff. And Napoleon goes, no.
Yeah. He's a toxic person at this point. Nobody wants to touch him. Nobody wants to even be associated with him. He is basically exiled. I mean, he's an untouchable, right?
And he's broke. So he can't go back to the United States. He has to wait around in France for a while. And it's not till 1811 a French ship is on the way back to the United States, and he's able basically to beg a ride.
Exactly. I mean, that probably didn't come easy either. You know, nobody even wanted him as a passenger on their freighter. So back home, he changes his name.
Sure.
To Edwards.
Like Timothy Edwards?
Yeah, exactly.
Callbacks.
In 1833, he does marry an Eliza. Which, it wasn't Eliza Hamilton's wife?
Yeah, but
weird, unrelated, yeah. But just, you know, ironic.
Yeah. She is wealthy. She is a socialite. Their marriage doesn't last long because he burns through her entire estate. He wastes all her money. He's broke again. He dies in debt on September 14th, 1836, the same day his wife's divorce paperwork comes through.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, I felt like, and I've said it a couple of times, that like leading up to the duel and all of that, he didn't seem like just absolute villain material. You know, I mean, everybody in politics has their double dealings and slimy behaviors.
Clinton played the saxophone.
That's true.
Barack Obama had a tan suit one time.
I just mean nobody in, especially in this area, was beyond reproach. You know, like people were doing backstabby kind of stuff all the time.
Constantly.
This dude just sort of got that label sort of like just absolutely emblazoned on his reputation, but he wasn't the only one.
Right.
But then this last chapter of his life, the idea of like, being a bit of a, he sort of became the villain that everyone said he was the whole time.
He was a broken man.
Yeah.
And it's not a fate that you want to wish on people. It's clearly possible. I mean, history hinges on such tiny things. It's clearly possible that had just a few other variables changed, he would have been the martyr, or he would have maybe have led a more successful political career.
I mean, but to jump in here, and I think this is an important thing, election of 1800, I mean, Hamilton basically said, I hate Thomas Jefferson. This guy's awful. This guy's terrible. You need to vote for him instead of Aaron Burr.
Yes.
I think there's, I don't know about Burr. I think just the awful things he did didn't become well known until he did enough awful things. Obviously.
Yeah, yeah. But then also you could, I mean, when you hold an objective mirror of retrospect up to the founding dudes, you're going to be hard-pressed to find a paragon of nobility amid any of them.
I think that's what I was getting at. And I'm not giving this guy a pass. He obviously sucked, but...
Oh, yeah, he's not good.
Not a good dude, but like a lot of these other politicians...
He's America's drunk uncle.
Yeah, well, we never really talked about him getting drunk.
Oh, well, everybody was drunk.
Okay, fair.
At that point.
And he was
American
pretty drunk
history.
When, I think, for a lot of these things.
Yeah, he was kind of doing a Giuliani. Okay.
No, it's true. That guy's, like, that guy apparently...
It's heartbreaking though, because you don't want to think about someone dying or even having to live in such circumstances.
Right.
And he also, while he himself was seen as perhaps a traitor to his friends and his political colleagues, he, again, toward the end of his life, he was suspected of being treasonous, but he was never proven to be a traitor. He just certainly hung out with people who later became traitors. Maybe that's where we sew it up. What about our buddy James Wilkinson?
Co-conspirator, the guy that also...
Wee Willie.
He then like backstabbed Burr, right, by producing that letter that led to his trial for treason. He also had a bit of a circuitous path to traitordom. He won election and then refused to leave after his term. There's a great quote from an article from Team Mighty over at wearethemighty.com about Wilkinson in this situation. It says, quote, Wilkinson was one of the most trusted soldiers in the U.S. Army history. Serving in both the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812, he took on the role of governor of the newly acquired Louisiana Territory and became one of the Army's most senior officers. There were many problems with Wilkinson's service, but the foremost among them was that he had been spying for the Spanish most of the time.
Whoops. Not all of the time, but most of the time.
And so that's treason, too.
Yes, that
talk
is
about
also
bad. The pot calling the kettle black when he did, again, turn Burr in for treason.
And then he almost gets caught up in this A-bomb nonsense, Aaron Burr's treason trial. And so here's what Wilkinson does. When he finds out that he might be revealed as a treasonous dude, a rude dude himself, as our friends of Ridiculous Crime would say, Wilkinson, Old Wee Willie places the entirety of New Orleans under martial law.
Like you do.
And locks up anyone who might be able to prove his involvement.
Ugh.
He never gets caught during his life. He does get away clean, but his papers, his correspondences are discovered in 1854. And the stuff that's in them led Theodore Roosevelt to say, "In all our history, there's no more despicable character."
Yeah, what a dick.
What did he say? We don't know at this point.
Well, but again, I mean, putting a whole city under martial law just to save your butt,
right.
Like that's the behavior of a very powerful and desperate man. We mentioned Benedict Arnold, which is, I don't think Eggs Benedict are named after Benedict Arnold. I would like to think not. That would really turn me on Eggs Benedict, because I like Eggs Benedict.
Mm-hmm. And Benedict Arnold, yeah, if you've seen things like Turn, right? He is most famous for, you know, stepping on the wrong side of the U.S. government. He was raised in a pretty good family in Norwich, Connecticut. He was originally going to be a pharmacy guy. He apprenticed with an apothecary. He joined the militia during the French and Indian War. He became a successful private trader. The Revolutionary War breaks out. He joins the Continental Army. And during the war, in his time as a military dude, he seems brave. He's skilled. He's a good leader. He does. He's got a couple of real hero moments. He helps capture Fort Ticonderoga in 75. He takes part in an unsuccessful attack on Quebec, the British part of it.
Much like our boy Aaron Burr. Wait, isn't that where they, maybe that's where they met each other, was during that attack on Quebec. The invasion, remember the unsuccessful invasion
of
Canada?
This invasion gives Benedict Arnold the promotion he's aiming for, too. He becomes a brigadier general.
Interesting. I mean, but, you know, it also benefited benefited Burr. By the way, I just Googled, is Eggs Benedict named after Benedict Arnold? It is not. But the second most popular Google result was, is Eggs Benedict named after Benedict Cumberbatch?
Oh, wow.
Who was like, you know, an actor
I remember
of recent time.
Reading this, you know, I love food history. I remember reading this, but I can't remember how it got the name. Was it named for a place?
It was a person.
It's a person.
It does appear that it was, let's see, Miss Le Grand Benedict grew bored of the menu at a particular place and complained about its lack of variety and requested something new to be made. Chef Ranhofer spontaneously created the now famous Eggs Benedict dish and named it after her. And this would have been in, let's see, the Delmonico.
Ah, like Steak Delmonico.
That's
what
right.
I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that
New
was
York.
The origin point for so many amazing recipes.
That's right. 1837.
You can look at, if you ever want to have fun, folks, you can look at the old Delmonico menu. You will be shocked by the prices. And dare I say, you might be shocked by some of the variety. They've got some weird stuff on there.
Roast beast.
Yeah. Our buddy Benny does some other cool stuff during the war. He gets the support of George Washington. He distinguishes himself in multiple campaigns, but it's the military. People are also gunning for the same promotion you want. Arnold has enemies within the military, and he's mad. He's spitting mad in 1777. A group of lower-ranking dudes get promoted ahead of him. They got a leapfrog. He's thinking, I'm supposed to be next in line. He marries a second time. He's living it up in Philly. Cream cheese every day. Everything bagels.
Fancy.
He racks up a lot of debt. And he's got these money problems. And he's got this personal resentment that he was not promoted. And he's like, I did my level best. You know, why are these guys getting favors over me? And
that's when he turns to the dark side.
That's when he turns to the Sith Lord stuff. That probably was the deciding factor, the money problems and the resentment.
Yep.
And no one finds out for a second. In 1780, Arnold takes over West Point. And this is before it's the home of the U.S. Military Academy. It's just, it's
a base.
Yeah,
it's a fort. Yeah, fort, exactly. Mm-hmm. He contacts Sir Henry Clinton, the head of the British forces, and just says, hey, I got an idea. How about I just give you the fort and my men?
Mm-hmm. And the guy goes, what?
Presumably for cash? What's the quid pro quo here, Ben? It's not really stated clearly.
Yeah, he meets with a British major, John Andre, on September 21st of that same year, 1780, and they crack a deal. And he says, "You dirty American, I will give you a large sum of money.
Okay, got it.
And I will also promote you in the British Army." Mm. So you could have that promotion.
He'll never be accepted. What is he going to do, a fake British accent? They'll see right through it.
They might. But, they probably sounded very similar, these guys.
That's a good point at that time. Yeah, that's a really good point.
But he would definitely be marked as a traitor. The thing about rats is that
nobody trusts them.
Yeah, so he was still going to get a lot of money, solve his money problems, get promoted to the British Army, ostensibly. However, he gets found out, and his buddy, the point of contact who can make this treason possible and worth it, Andre gets captured. Andre is murdered. Benedict Arnold flees to the enemy side. Help me, help me, help me.
Remember? We had a thing.
We had a deal.
We're buddies.
Wait for me. No. And then they give him some British troops, and he commands them in Virginia and Connecticut. That's got to be a trip. If you're on the American side of it, you're like, hang on a second.
Yeah, I know that asshole.
Yeah. That's the moment they have. And eventually, he survives.
He does move to England.
He moves to England.
But he never gets all of the accolades and, wealth and riches that were promised to him by the British. Once again, the story of a former great American hero and patriot who died, maybe not a pauper, but, definitely not with reverence and respect and admiration, mainly in, obscurity, on June 14th, 1801.
And lest we end on a down note, the Delmonico restaurant in New York is also responsible for Baked Alaska and Lobster Newburgh.
I don't know Lobster Newburgh. What's Lobster Newburgh?
It's got a very distinct smell. I've cooked it at home. It's kind of a pain because you have to use brandy in the recipe.
I like brandy and like a lobster bisque, lobster bisque.
Yeah, like a sherry or something.
Sherry, too. I guess. Yeah. I get a few sherry and brandy.
No, I mean, you can tell. I think I don't think either of us really cook a ton with alcohol outside of like put some wine and like a beef stew or something.
Yeah, or like a little white wine and like a pasta of some kind.
Yeah. Oh, that's smart. Yeah. Like seafood pasta kind of thing.
Definitely. Yes, nice. Exactly. I like doing shrimp and rice too with diced roasted red peppers. Mm-hmm. And then you put a little, I actually like to cook the rice with half wine and half chicken broth instead of water.
But I've never put wine in it.
It's really nice. It's also what you would do for like a paella or something. I guess that's what we got. We've got a story of one of America's biggest traitors and a bunch of other little side players and Hamilton and all of the things.
And what a wild ride. We know we made this a two-part episode, folks. That's because there's so much stuff we wanted to
preemptive.
Get to. Yeah, preemptive on purpose. And we want to thank the following people so much for making the show possible. First off, you, Ridiculous Historians, thanks for tuning in. First, our super producer and research associate for this series, Mr. Max Williams. Who else?
All the hits. Jonathan Strickland, the Quizster, our personal Aaron Burr, Benedict Arnold, and the other guy. What was his name? The most despicable one?
James Wilkinson.
That's it. Wilkinson, you dog.
I also want to be fair and say, it was a tremendous pleasure to hang out with Jonathan a little bit in Vegas.
Absolutely. He almost got assassinated by a seafood tower.
He did. I was sitting next to him. This is a true story. He has a shellfish allergy.
Deathly allergic to shellfish. Christopher Asiotis here in spirit. Eve's Jeffcoat. Alex Williams, who composed our theme. Alex, I don't know your last name, but who's visiting us in the studio?
Alex Circa
1900.
There we go.
I love it.
Street name. You go with that one, Alex?
Okay.
You want another one?
That's like pretty good.
A-bomb?
That's okay. Pretty good. Alex Circa 1900 is a pretty good history nickname. Fine.
Hey. We won't expose your real birthday.
Okay, right? Fair.
Because that's unfair. But yes, and no, of course. Thanks to you, man.
You as well, Ben. We'll see you next time, folks.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.